So from where we are, it's 4,000 years. 4,000 years. The story has, if you take a look over there, we have the Anchor Bible. The Genesis volume of that was done by the late Professor E.A. Spicer, the Assyriologist from the University of Pennsylvania. Spicer writes that as far as his reading of Genesis goes, the story of Abraham is historically accurate. What we know from archaeology, what we know from the study of other literatures, all fits together with the dating of the story of Abraham at about 2000 BC. So the Bible itself starts in the historical period of the Bible, which is the story of Abraham, this week's Parsha, and goes as far as about 500 BCE. So the Bible covers about 1,500 years, 2,000 BCE to 500 BCE. Okay? When I say 500 BCE, what is that? You've got the books of Daniel, you've got Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah describe the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel from Babylonia, where Daniel went when the people were exiled by the Babylonians. They return and they rebuild the city. Nehemiah is about the building of the walls, and then eventually a second temple is built. That's roughly about 500 BCE. The Talmud as we have it reflects the literary tradition of the Jews after that period. Okay? Now, it doesn't in all likelihood have a lot of material that's immediately after that period, because that literature is contained in books that we have, most of which we have, we don't have all of them, but most of which we have, but which are, interestingly enough, we Jews consider them to be non-canonical books. The Apocrypha, for example. You have perhaps heard of the Apocrypha. A Catholic Bible contains the Apocrypha. Books in the Apocrypha were written in that period of time, roughly between 500 and zero. 500 to zero. There's another branch of literature there called the pseudepigrapha, also roughly from that time. I'll give you an example of one of the books of the Apocrypha, which even if you haven't read it, you know about, two of them, which are the books of the Maccabees. The books of the Maccabees you know about because you know the Hanukkah story. And the Hanukkah story is not in the Bible. It is not in a Jewish Bible. You get a Jewish Bible, you can buy the Jewish Publication Society edition of the Bible, you will not find the Hanukkah story. You buy the Talmud, you will not really find the Hanukkah story. Talmud will tell you a little bit about Hanukkah, but it's a totally different story than the historical sources we have in the Apocrypha, in the two books of Maccabees in the Apocrypha. Okay? All that we know, at least until fairly recently, of the ancient world is based on literature. In the last 200 years, with the development of archaeology, we now have additional sources to examine together with the literature. The literature, however, is for the Jews the main source of continuity, because the literature portrays and develops the values, the ideas, and in fact the continuity of institutions that exist in the people. For example, by institutions I mean, if you remember reading in the Torah, Moses sets up courts. You remember the story of Jethro. Moses is taking care of legal cases. Jethro, his father-in-law, comes along and says, Moses, you're never going to be able to handle all these people who are coming to see you. You need courts. Okay? So you have legal institutions that you can see already in that period of time. What happens to them? Anytime you will have a people, you will have institutions. Anytime you will have a nation, you will have to have a continuity of institutions. to the extent that one knows about those, one knows most richly about them from the literature, from whatever literature we have that has been preserved. Every once in a while, you hope you'll find a new piece of literature that you never knew about before, and it happens. It happened, for example, with the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are things that we now know about the spiritual life of Jewish sectarians, of sects of Jews, at about the year zero, which we didn't know before those scrolls were discovered. They were discovered by some Bedouin, they were dealt with by some Arab sellers of artifacts. Eventually they became the province of scholars. So every once in a while we do discover something that we didn't have before. As a matter of fact, tonight I'm actually going to show you something that's relevant to our study of Moed Katan, which we didn't have before. It's relatively new that you will see. But again, it is literature that really provides for us the continuity of ideas and of institutions. Judaism as well. Judaism is a civilization that has in its literature a great religion. And religion to some extent deals with ethics and to some extent deals with rituals. For example, the Torah will tell us about the festival of Passover. Okay? On the first day there shall be a festival day, and on the last day there shall be a festival day. In 7 days you shall eat no leavened bread. Okay? Well, you have a first day and you have a last day. And in fact, we know pretty well what the laws of the first day and the last day are. Because it says you shall do no manner of labor. Milacha. And we know more or less what that means. Except that the Torah also says, as far as the holidays go, you may, however, prepare food. You may prepare your food. In fact, you can cook on a holiday, whereas you cannot cook on the Sabbath. Okay? But if I said to you that the festival of Passover is 7 days long, and in fact it's 8 days long here where we live in the diaspora, and the Torah says that the first day and the last day shall be festival days, the question is, what do you do in the middle of the holiday? Do you put on tefillin or do you not put on tefillin? How do you deal with the middle of the holiday? Is the middle of the holiday a festival or is it not a festival? That is what this tractate is all about. It is the tractate of Moed Katan, the small Moed. Moed is a festival. Moed is a festival. So this is the minor festival. Minor festival meaning the days between the actual festival days. How do we know what those traditions are? We go to the literature. Sometimes we will be able to see that this literature will quote things from 2,000 years before. Sometimes it will quote things as if this is just something that everybody knows, even though they don't have a literary source for it. We don't know until we'll actually look at it. Okay? Specifically, we are going to be interested in a topic that comes up in the third chapter of Masechet Moed Katan, the tractate of Moed Katan, and it is the subject of mourning, the laws of mourning. Most Jews know that mourning involves a variety of rituals, a variety of things that we are not supposed to do, some things that we are supposed to do. And frankly, most Jews have some knowledge of that because sooner or later we have some contact in our personal lives, with our friends, family, with death. How many of our customs go back to the Torah? Does the Torah command us to do the variety of things that we do? To sit Shiva, for example. Where do we know to sit Shiva? Where do we know the customs of mourning, such as rending a garment? Where do we know the customs of mourning that decree a 30-day period of mourning and then a year period of mourning? chances are that even if you know the Torah, you don't readily know the answer to that question. Interestingly enough, that question is not easy to answer. I can tell you very readily and easily where the laws of the Sabbath come from, at least all the basic laws. I can tell you where the laws of Yom Tov come from. I can tell you where ever so many of the ethical laws come from in the Torah itself. But the mentions of mourning are first of all few. They're not none. They're few. And they are indirect. Indirect. For example, we will see after certain people die that there is a statement that the people mourned for 30 days when Jacob dies. When Jacob dies. When Moses dies. We see that there is a reflection that shows us that there were customs. Although the way of the Torah usually is to say, thou shalt do this for X, Y, and Z. And that's not what I just said. I just said that it says that they did this. So that it's not exactly clear that this is mandatory. Is it mandatory? And if it is it mandatory because the Torah mandates it? Or does it have a different level of authority behind it? Why is the subject of mourning in a tractate about the intermediate days of the festival? You would think if we're going to study mourning, we would study a tractate about mourning. And there is a small post-Talmudic tractate that is about mourning. Most of our laws, the great source of the laws here in the Talmud, then, come in this tractate, because you will see there is some analogy to be made between the laws of mourning and the laws of the intermediate days of the festival. There are certain prohibitions of behavior in the intermediate days of the festival which are like the prohibitions of mourning. And you will see, in fact, that not only is there an analogy to be drawn between the laws of the intermediate days of the festival, but there will be other categories, legal categories of individuals, which also are like the laws of mourning. Now, I say this to you not only just as a general introduction, but because I think that it's interesting to approach a chapter like this with an open mind to try and figure out what the psychology is behind the law. And I said that advisedly, psychology. I usually have not said that to you. I didn't tell you you should think of the psychology of the laws of cooking. I never thought it was not relevant to the focus of the discussion. Mourning is psychologically a profound thing. And I think that it would stand to reason just out of nowhere that if there are practices of mourning, they probably have something to do with the psychological response to death. Then, if there are analogies created between the intermediate days of the festival, and as you will see, a variety of other states, like the person who has leprosy, like the person who has been put under the ban of a court, all of these things we're going to see shortly, and we will see that the laws in all of these cases, if not identical, are similar to one another. I just want you to allow yourselves to speculate on the psychology that is probably behind all of these laws as we begin to see the analogies that are made between these different things. Okay? So this is going to be a little bit different, the approach to this tractate. It will really, I think, ask us to try and figure out, as my daughter would say, what the headspace is of the people who are doing this and who are writing this, in order for us to get into the deeper level of what it means. Okay? Any questions so far?
Moses, if I remember correctly, he left the people, so nobody will know where he died or where he will be buried. Mm-hmm. So did they sit Shiva, or did they mourn about it?
But it says that they mourned him for 30 days.
He did say.
Yeah, but it doesn't say.
But since when? Nobody know, and really knows.
You don't have to know where it is. He went. They know
when
where
he died.
Went
they didn't even know when he died. He just left them.
But they must have gotten some indication, because the Torah says that they mourned him for 30 days. Yeah, whatever, however it was communicated, that's what it says.
I don't remember the...
Well, what it says then is that it doesn't say that they didn't know where he died. It says that nobody knows where he died till this day. So in other words, we don't know. Subsequently,
we have not marked
the place, so that we don't know where it was. Okay? Okay. Now, a few things about the study of Talmud. If you have a text, open your text to the beginning of chapter 3. In the Moed Katan, it's 13b6. If you don't have a text, I made Xeroxes, but only of the Hebrew text. So if this is totally foreign to you, then it might not be worthwhile. I just want to show you a little bit about the geography of what's on the page. So I'll pass some of these around. This is the first page that we'll be dealing with. And maybe we'll do the second page too if we get there. The way the Talmud works, Talmud was printed for the first time in Venice, the end of the 15th century. And you have to keep that in mind. The Talmud before that was a manuscript. The Talmud that we have, that we use, is the result of the manuscripts. Some work that's been done fairly recently, but we have this way of printing the Talmud is what you call the Vilna edition of the Talmud. This is the Vilna Talmud. Herb, for example, is sitting here with a somewhat different edition of the Talmud, which is the Steinsaltz Talmud that's being put out in Israel now. It uses the same framework of publication, but it actually looks a little bit different. Got other things on the page. The standard edition of the Vilna Talmud, first of all, puts the Talmud in the middle of the page. Right? Keep that in mind. The Talmud is now in the middle of the page. It is surrounded by a variety of commentaries. The principal commentary that we need to understand the Talmud is always what?
Rashi.
Rabbi Samuel Yitzhaki, Shmuel Yitzhaki. Shlomo Yitzchaki, Solomon Yitzchaki, Solomon ben Yitzchak, Rashi. Resh Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. Those are the initials. He lived in the city of Troyes, 1040 to 1105. So he was a French Talmudist who lived in the 11th century. That was Rashi. Immediately after Rashi, his own children and grandchildren of the French Talmudists studied Rashi and added additional commentaries, and those are called Tosafot. The Rashi is always next to the Talmud, which is in the middle of the page, and it's on the binding side. So it's always next to the binding. That's the convention of Talmudic publication.
always look at the Bible. Similarly, the Tosafot, which date now from the 12th century, is on the direct opposite side. These are the Tosafot right here. Okay, those are the Tosafot. In addition to Rashi and the Tosafot, any tractate of the Talmud will also include additional commentaries. They nearly all will include the glosses, which show you where to find a particular issue in the legal literature. That's up here, called Ein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah. That tells you where to go in the Shulchan Aruch. That is the standard code of Jewish law of the 16th century. And where to go to read it in Maimonides, the code of Jewish law which Maimonides wrote in the 1179, the end of the 12th century. Okay? So that's here. And there will be, depending upon the particular tractate, additional commentaries also around the side. Okay? One of the interesting challenges of studying the chapter Moed Katan actually is a manuscript problem. And I want to tell you about that before we begin, which is why I have brought my magnifying glass. Commentators realized early on in the game, already in the 14th, the 15th, and the 16th centuries, which is to say, before the printing press, that there seemed to be numerous contradictions in some of the Rashis that they were reading. Rashi wrote a commentary on nearly all of the tractates, maybe all of them, but we don't have his commentary to all of the tractates. Because again, you have to keep in mind that things were kept in manuscript. And there may not have been a lot of manuscripts. And who was to be sure that the manuscript would be well guarded? You know, Jewish life is frequently precarious. And it wasn't as if you could print something. There was no such thing. So that you tried to preserve manuscripts to the extent that you could, and it wasn't, in fact, until the end of the 15th century, when the printing press was invented, that you had many copies which were relatively inexpensive of what had heretofore been a manuscript. In the 16th century, and in the 17th century already, many, many scholars felt that the Rashi to Moed Katan was corrupt. There was something essentially wrong with it. They did this by analyzing the way in which earlier commentators on the Talmud quoted Rashi. The earlier commentators quoted Rashi, and it wasn't the same Rashi they were reading. So that nobody knew what had happened to Rashi. The Bamberg printed the Talmud in Venice, printed it the way we have it here with the Rashi, and yet the Rashi didn't fit what other earlier commentators said Rashi said. Rashi also wrote another commentary to the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, a Sephardi commentator, a legist, halachist, who lived in North Africa, in Tunisia, Alfasi, Fez, in that area. And Rashi's commentary there contradicted his commentary here. Scholars were perplexed about what this all meant. Until for the first time, 1960, there was published the results of a lone manuscript which was found in a monastery in Spain, which is the Rashi to Moed Katan. It was found in the monastery of San Lorenzo of Escorial in Spain.
And this manuscript was written on parchment. It was apparently poorly done, but it clearly dated from the 13th or the 14th centuries. The scholars that located this and that eventually published it, I don't know, it was very recent, 1960. This came out in a volume that was published by the Mikitse Nir Damim, a group of American and Israeli scholars, of whom I had the privilege of studying with. One of them was Shaul Lieberman, who was my teacher of Talmud, and the other one of whom was Shalom Spiegel, who I'm happy to say I shared an office with my first years of teaching in the seminary. Unfortunately, Professor Spiegel, who was professor of Bible and Hebrew literature, had developed Parkinson's disease. And eventually he was hardly able to, and in those days there was no way of treating Parkinson's disease. And he had this wonderful office with all of his books, and when I went back to the seminary as a graduate student and started teaching there, it was after I was ordained, it was a free office, so they put me in Spiegel's office. So I had a wonderful time, because every once in a while he would collect books from his office, and I got to know him by sitting in his chair. I sat in Spiegel's chair. Spiegel was one of the people who functioned here. The head of the Mikitse Nir Damim was Shmuel Yosef Agnon, the Israeli Nobel Prize winner, Shlomo Dov Goitein, who taught at Princeton until his death, Gershom Scholem, who was the great historian of Jewish mysticism, and Aleph Urbach, who was the great professor of rabbinics at the Hebrew University. So these were an extraordinary group of people who were writing creatively basically from 1950 to about 1970, maybe a little bit after, maybe as far as 75 or so. They're all gone now. But these were people who knew the entire literature, so they were not interested in that. They were only interested in the things that you couldn't figure out in the literature, since they knew it all. They knew where the problems were in our understanding of the literature. And so they searched for manuscripts. And they found this lone manuscript on the tractate of Moed Katan, which then fit all of the other Rashis that were known from the earlier commentators. And that's why they have no doubt that we now have Rashi's commentary to Moed Katan. It was published, when I studied this the first time, it was published in a separate volume. This is the volume that it came out with in 6061. Interestingly enough, the Art Scroll has now published this commentary in this edition. I don't know whether it has been published anywhere else. I suspect it probably has. I don't have an edition of the Talmud with it. This is the only one that I own that has it. And I want to show you where it is. Then you'll understand why I brought the magnifying glass. It is in the Art Scroll. It is here called Rashi Kaf Taf / Yud. Kaf Taf / Yud. You see that? You have to get your finger on it. Can you see that?
Excuse me.
Rashi. Kaf, taf, / yud. This is it. And what that is a Hebrew abbreviation of Kitab Yad. Yeah. Kitab Yad Rashi. The Rashi manuscript.
So this is the Rashi manuscript that was put out by the Mikitzei Nir Dami. This is the actual Rashi, published now for the first time in the Vilna Talmud, in the Vilna Shas. Okay? The Rashi that we always had appears to probably be the work of Rabbeinu Gershom Ma'or HaGolah. Rabbeinu Gershom lived in the 10th century in the Rhineland, German rabbi, who wrote many commentaries. The most famous thing that most people know about Rabbeinu Gershom was the Takanot Rabbeinu Gershom, which forbid men to marry more than one wife. That was the famous Takanot Rabbeinu Gershom.
And read other people's letters.
He was the one who prohibited polygamy in Judaism. And that was the way most people know about Rabbeinu Gershom. Apparently, his commentary to Moed Katan got into the standard edition of the Vilna Shas as it was published, first by Bamberg in Venice, even though it wasn't Rashi. It was called Rashi. And now, for the first time, we have Rashi. I don't know about you, but the only way I can read the Rashi is with this. So I sit there with a magnifying glass, and then I can read the Rashi. So even as I teach, it's too small for me to read. Because now it's this very, very tiny print toward the bottom of the page. Those of you who want to tackle it, good luck. And buy a good magnifying glass.
So how much of it turned out to be contradictory and how much complementary between the two?
It's about 50%. Or maybe a little less than that. They say 50%. In other words, an awful lot. It's kind of interesting because you would think how much conflict you have about one text. Mm-hmm. But apparently there's not.
Why'd they do it in Rashi script?
You like it not in Rashi script?
Yeah.
If it's Rashi, come
on. It's hot enough.
Steinzel has that. What does he have?
Doesn't seem to be anything unless he said.
Let me just see. Let's see which one is. Read to me the first Rashi of the chapter, and we'll see. Let's see what Steinzel says. Wait, hold on. Let me find the place. Wait. Come on up. Just a minute. And if you get. I use these small books, by the way, because they're easier to carry. But there is an obvious problem with it. The Rashi is even smaller. Okay. So that
That's the original.
Oh,
so shame on you, Steinsaltz.
No, so I'm not going to get that.
No, I'm not sure. Go on again. You sure you're reading the Rashi? Not Tosafot?
He's reading from.
I'm reading from the Rashi. Okay, that's the Rabbeinu Gershom. That's Rabbeinu Gershom. Okay, so he's not using the Rashi manuscript. Okay. Good.
Interesting question as to why he didn't.
It's a good question.
The truth is, when
it was done late enough to include that.
I don't know when it was done. I can't say that with as much certainty as you do, because he didn't do his volumes in order. Steinsaltz did not do the volumes in order, so I don't know exactly when he did that volume. At this stage of the game, I was surprised. I checked the art school in particular. I was sort of, and my hunch was that they would not have known about this manuscript. But this goes to prove what I've often said to you, which is against the conventional thought, that we would assume that the art school world doesn't know about what the Jewish Theological Seminary did and does. That one is called Orthodox, the other is called Conservative,
and the Orthodox are opposed to the conservative, and the conservative is opposed to the Orthodox. That's not true. That the work of the seminary, because it is good scholarship, is just plain good scholarship, and anybody else, sooner or later, who's intelligent enough, is going to have to use that scholarship. And that, in fact, is what has happened. It took 40 years. It takes 40 years for those things to finally get them to trickle down, but after 40 years, it finally worked. And so now it's published with the seminary's work.
With accreditation?
With what?
With accreditation?
Accreditation? No. I shouldn't say that, because if you look in the beginning, he refers to Kupfer, who was the scholar who published this, and Kupfer is credited with the work on the manuscript. So I shouldn't say no. Is not, but you don't have to do that. I mean, it's appropriate for them to have quoted Kupfer, and they do that. Okay.
The question is, why did they continue to publish the Rashi?
It's difficult to
know. They should switch them around, right? They should put in the bigger print the real Rashi, and put in the little print.
Is it because for 500 years?
Yeah.
You cannot take it out. Okay.
Basically, it's hard to make those changes. It'll take at least another 40 years, right? If it ever happens.
But has there grown a whole edifice of commentary on the corrupted Rashi over the centuries?
Yes. Yep. There has. But a lot of it was questioning the accuracy of the Rashi. So a lot of it was just questioning, assuming it was a separate commentary, but just wondering how it fit. So a lot of it is of that nature.
Who would make that sort of decision, or would it vary from publisher to publisher?
Well, Talmud was not published all that many times. So the Talmud itself was, whoever made the decision made it in Venice in the 15th century, okay? The others who were writing commentaries, anybody could write a commentary on the Talmud, and an awful lot of people did. So in their commentaries, they raised problems with the Rashi. That's the history of it.
But I mean, like now, yeah. You said it's not so easy to, why wouldn't they, who would make the decision to take out the...
Somebody, you could do it, but it's still, to me, it was a radical thing that I saw that Art Scroll put in what the Mekitzenir Namim did. I didn't expect them to do that. Now look, I'm used to heresy. I'm used to all kinds of things that I think Art Scroll's not used to, and they're doing it. They're doing it. But I think it's, if you know people in that world, they're in a very conventional world. Change comes very, very slowly. It can come, but only very slowly. That's the way it happens. Now, some of it is also expense. I mean, I don't know exactly how they are publishing Talmuds today. I believe that the Talmud today, only the last few years, and I don't have an edition of the Talmud that reflects this. The edition we have here does not reflect this. The last few years, the Talmud, as we know it, the Vilna Talmud, has been put into digital form. Most of these changes never happened because nobody wanted to reset the type. And it's a tremendous job to reset the type of the Talmud. That's why once the Vilna Talmud was set, it was set. And then when I was a student, everything that we read was simply a photo offset, because that was the technology. It was this photo offset of the Vilna Talmud. And it was just whether it was a good edition that they photo offset or it was not a good edition that they photo offset. And every once in a while you get a real Vilna Talmud, you see one that was printed in Vilna, and it would blow you away. It was just so beautiful. We used to work when we were students with Talmuds that every once in a while you couldn't read them because photo offsets were of that quality when I was studying in the 60s. That was the reality of it. Today, however, the Talmud is being reset digitally. And that job has already been done. It's been done. It's done in Israel. The Israelis have done it.
Is there a master digital, and if publishers want to make their own changes, they can buy the master?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer. I honestly don't know the answer.
I'm sure that...
Because the same thing was done also with the Bible. It's the same question of the Bible. For many years, only now, last year for the first time, was it possible to buy the Jewish Publication Society's Bible digitally. Years ago, after Sarna, late Professor Nachum Sarna, who died this summer.
Yeah.
Some of you saw Sarna last night, his son, Jonathan Sarna. The late Professor Sarna, years ago, I invited him to give a lecture when I was still at Park Avenue, and Sarna said he was sat on the committee of the JPS Bible. So he said, you know, the terrible thing is, there's no way that we can reproduce this thing. It doesn't exist in computer form. Already then, I was working on a Macintosh, so I said, Professor Sarna, what do you mean? You can't put this thing on a Macintosh? It won't work? He said, look, I know about reading Bibles. I don't know about the technology of Bibles. He said, but they tell me it's not a doable job. All I can tell you is last year, for the first time, it was possible to buy the JPS Bible software. But I'll tell you the other side of it. I tried to open it the other day. I couldn't do it. I couldn't open it. It is so weirdly done.
It's a different font, and your computer cannot...
It's something beyond that. I can't even get that far. I had this problem when I bought it originally, that it was a very complicated thing to open. You had to open the internet at the same time as you... You had to get a key from here and a key from there. They were protecting it. I have other editions of the Bible in software, which are... I have the Talmud, I have the Bible, I have all this in software. I have all that stuff. But I wanted the JPS because it had this good English translation right next to the Hebrew. It's very helpful for me for teaching. And I tried to open it up for a lecture I gave nights ago, and I couldn't do it.
Noah can help you.
I could use it. Okay. So, again, this is where we are. Okay? So, that's the Rashi. This is the text. Now, go back again to this page. The third chapter begins down here at the bottom. Begins at the bottom. 1, 2, 3, 4 lines up from the bottom. And not from the bottom of the page, but from the bottom of the Talmudic text. Okay? On the pages, in Hebrew it's Yud Gimel with two dots next to it. 13b. Remember that the pages in the Talmud are marked by folio and side, not the way we normally mark pages. You don't have page 1 and page 2. You have page 1a and 1b. That's the way the Talmud works. So here, this is 13b. This is 13b that we're looking at. Those of you who will be following along in the English, don't get mixed up, because what happens in the English is that one page of the original takes up normally 4 to 6 pages of the English. English is much longer than the original. So therefore, the way ArtScroll has published this is that you've got this page will be repeated with one English page, 2 English pages, 3 English pages, 4 English pages, 5, however many it takes. Okay? So keep that in mind when you're trying to find your place. Sometimes you will see, I will say it's page 16b3. That refers to, in the English, a superscript that's up at the top here. This one, for example, is 16b6. So it's the 6th English page for page 16b.
13.
Okay, which is... 13, I'm sorry, 13b. It's the 6th English page of 13b. Right? Now, if you're not following along with the text, until you actually do this, you may feel like you're getting mixed up. So, but don't despair yet. Any questions? Okay, so let's go down to the bottom and let's start. Talmud is made up of two strata. The Mishnah and the Gemara. The Mishnah is older, It was edited by Rabbi Judah the Prince. It's 95% in Hebrew. It was edited in the year 200 CE in northern Israel. Okay? We visited the place where Rabbi Judah the Prince did this in Tzipori. In Tzipori, those of you who are with us on our trip, that's where he wrote the Mishnah. And the Mishnah, again, edited in the year 200. From that point of the editing of the Mishnah, for the next 300 years, scholars studied the Mishnah to interpret the meaning of the Mishnah. That is called the Gemara. The Gemara that we are studying is the Babylonian Gemara, the Babylonian Talmud. Because roughly the year 500, it was edited in Babylonia. Okay? 200, Mishnah. 500, Gemara. Gemara contains commentaries on the Mishnah, plus everything else in the world. Somebody had wanted to say something, he could say it, and it's in the Gemara. If you study the Gemara, I was talking to a woman who told me that that she decided to send to a school where they studied only Gemara. I said, we're not going to study science and mathematics and things like that. She says, it's all in the Gemara. And the truth is, it's true. It's true. I mean, everything that you can imagine, astronomy, everything is in the Gemara. Biology, it's all in the Gemara. Everything in the world is in the Gemara. It's the nature of the Gemara, okay? So when we study chapter 3, we will start with a Mishnah, and then we will proceed after the Mishnah to read the Gemara, which will be the interpretation of the Mishnah, interpretation plus. Any questions from here? Okay? Bottom of the page. Ve'elu megalchim b'moed. And these are those who are megalchim b'moed. Moed is the middle of the festival. When the Talmud says moed, it means chol ha-moed. Okay? Now, the word megalchim, excuse me, for you Hebrew speakers, is probably a little bit odd. What do you think it means?
Shave.
Modern Hebrew, Likaleach means to shave. In the Talmud, in all likelihood, it couldn't have meant that. Because Jews didn't shave. Romans shaved. Okay, you look at the statues, go across the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and take a look at Romans, statues of Romans. This is the Roman period that we're reading about here. Again, Rabbi Judah the Prince lived in Tzipori, and those of you who were there last year, you saw. One block was Jews, one block was Romans. They all lived together. Right? The rabbis were writing the Talmud, the Romans built an amphitheater where they had games. So the two cultures were living side by side with one another. The Romans, however they did it, shaved. I don't know exactly what was used, whether they used depilatories. Depilatories were always known. I mean, the Talmud is full of information about the depilatories. Or whether they used a razor. I don't know the answer to that. But the Jews did not. Jews did not. So megalchim here means listaper, to get a haircut. It means to get a haircut. So ve'elu megalchim b'moed. Which are the ones, now the art scroll translates, and these are the people, these are the ones who may cut their hair during the moed, the intermediate days of the festival. It may be that the form in the Mishnah, which says ve'elu, actually should be read as a question. It's a way of introducing a question. In other words, who are the people who are megalchim b'moed, who are allowed to cut their hair on the intermediate days of the festival. Haba mi medinat hayam,
The one who comes from literally a state by the sea. Umi Beit Hashivya, and from a house of captivity. Vahayotse mi Beit Asarim, and the person who comes out of prison. Vahaminudeh, the person who is under a ban. Shehitiru lo chachamim, which the sages freed him from. The chen mishenish alechacham v'hutar. Likewise, for somebody who asks a sage and is freed. The hanazir, a Nazarite. The hametzara, somebody with leprosy. Who comes out from his impurity to his purity. Let's go to here. Understand? In all likelihood, you can know what the words are. What is it talking about? Okay, what is it talking about? That's why we need Rashi. Okay. All right. I already said to you, Eilu Megalchim B'Moed. These are the ones who are permitted to cut their hair on the Moed, on the intermediate days of the festival. Now, of course, what does that make you think, by the way? What is assumed here? That there are people who can. Not only people who can, that there are exceptions to the general rule, which applies to everybody, that you can't cut your hair on the Moed. Who ever heard of that? Do you ever see that in the Torah? Even if you know the Torah. We know that it is prohibited to cut your hair on the first day of the festival. It is prohibited to cut your hair on the Sabbath. There are laws against shearing. And the human beings are not allowed to cut their hair because there's an analogy between the laws of shearing an animal, of cutting the hair off the goat or the sheep, and the cutting of human hair. It's prohibited to shave on the Sabbath. Same reason. Same thing. Okay? Now, but that's not Chol HaMoed. We understand why on the first day and the last day, you're not allowed to do those things. But the assumption here is that on Chol HaMoed, you're also not allowed to do it. Now, on the Yom Tov itself, you're not allowed to do those things. You're not allowed to cut the hair because the cutting of the hair is a milacha. It is a forbidden labor according to the Torah, at least according to the way the rabbis understand the Torah. It is a milacha, a prohibited labor of the festival. It happens to also be a prohibited labor of the Sabbath. Okay? Those are prohibited on the Sabbath and on the festival. But in the middle of the festival, we're going to have to wonder what is behind this. Okay? I'm not going to answer it yet because I just want you to think of what are the questions. So who are those people who are able to megalchin, to cut their hair on the moed? Haba mi midinat hayam. Okay? Now here I'm reading the Rashi. This is the manuscript Rashi. Haba mi midinat hayam b'moed, a person who comes from the state by the sea, literally, b'moed, on Chol HaMoed, on Chol HaMoed. What this means is, let us say you're traveling. You're abroad. Right? Midinat hayam means somewhere overseas or far away. Now, you can't come back on the festival itself, on the festival day. Why? You can't travel. Okay. You can't be far enough away. If you're that far away, you can't make it back on the festival day. But comes Chol HaMoed. First day of Pesach is over. The first day of Sukkot is over. And you get on your donkey, and you come. Or you take your boat. You're in your Midinat Hayam, let's say you're up in Tyre, you're up in Lebanon somewhere. Take a boat and you land in Jaffa. You can't do that on the Yom Tov, you can't do that. But you could do it on a Chol HaMoed. That is Haba Mimedinat Tayam, the person who comes from a place by the sea, in other words, from abroad. And Rashi adds, B'moed, on Chol HaMoed, not before the Moed. Not the day before Pesach, not the day before Sukkot, but the person who comes on Chol HaMoed itself, okay? Shelo haya lo panai legaleach kodem ha-moed. This person was on a boat. Ship travel was dangerous. It was scary, and he was worried about where he was going and when he was going to get there, and then the holiday intervened. He was all concerned. Do you think he had time to go to the barber? No, he didn't have time, okay? Lo haya lo panai. He had no free time. Had no panai. Legalech kodem ha-moed. To get a haircut before the moed. Okay, that's the first category that is an exception to the prohibition of cutting the hair on Chol HaMoed. Questions? No, we go to the next one. Next one says, Umi Beit HaShidya, the person who comes from a house, I translated that as a house of captivity. Rashi, Mi Beit HaShidya, Shehishbe'uhu Goyim Lamerchakim. Gentiles kept that person in captivity at a great distance from his home. Right? That person too, he was captured by Gentiles. It was a frequent occurrence. Gentiles would capture Jews. You know why they captured Jews?
For ransom.
For ransom. They would ransom.
That's where Castro got his idea of taking our planes.
It was a
he studied Talmud.
It was a good way to make money. And therefore, they knew that the Jews were concerned to get their families back, and therefore that the Jews would pay if they captured Jews. So this is a case now where somebody has been captured and is freed, either because in fact the ransom was paid, whatever it was, or the person escaped. Could be any of a variety of reasons. Again, the assumption being that the person could not get a haircut before the moed. After all, you're in captivity, you're coming back, even if you arrive right before the moed. You know, that's not the first thing you think about. You want to see a family. You don't want to think, first of all, about getting a haircut. So we allow that person also to get a haircut on the moed. Okay, the next one. V'hayotzei mibeit ha'asurim. A person who comes out of prison. Afilu bi'iro. Now here Rashi adds, afilu bi'iro, even in his own city. Right, these other situations were assumed that there was distance involved. The guy couldn't get home. But here, if he was in prison, he could have even been local. Right, he was in prison, got out of prison on Chol HaMoed. Right, so in theory also, you might say, well, he could have gotten a haircut in prison. Right, why didn't he get a haircut in prison? That's what the Tosafot talk about. Tosafot says, "She'eno yachol legaleach kodem ha-moed, she'en menichim lo legaleach." They don't allow you in prison to get a haircut when you want it. V'afilu menichilo, and even if they allow you to get a haircut, "Eino arev li'adam legaleach be'beit ha-asurim." Nobody likes to get a haircut in prison. People neglect their own taking care of themselves when they're in prison. So it's not what you think about. You know, this is not the guy's concern. So this guy, if he finally gets out of prison, right, finally gets out of prison, we allow him to cut his hair on the moed. Okay? Let's see, we have still a little bit of time. Let's do another one. The chen mishenish ala chacham v'hutar. A person who asks a sage and is freed. Who asks a sage and is freed. Rashi. Shenadar. Mishenash. Nish'al shenadar shelo legaleach. Somebody who took a vow not to get a haircut. My son once in a while takes that vow. 2 years go by, the guy doesn't seem to get a haircut. I don't know
how much money
on.
He saved.
You have this problem?
No, you know how much money he saved? You can buy a gallon of gasoline.
As my mother used to say to me, my mother used to say to me before I came home from college, here's the money. Don't walk in the door until you've had a haircut.
Were you a hippie?
Sorry.
Were you a hippie?
No, I was a normal person. We never got haircuts. Who would spend money on a haircut? There were so many other things that were more important in life than getting a haircut. You get a haircut for one reason. You know why? Because your mother was going to see you. That's why you got a haircut. So many reasons. Okay? Okay. Okay.
He looks very well.
Yeah, he looks funny. I got used to it. He looks good. Mishu nishal, so a guy takes a vow not to cut his hair, not to get a haircut. Okay? And he changes his mind. Sha'asa atzmo nazir. And a guy decides he wants to make himself like a Nazirite. Nazirites don't cut their hair. Right? That's one way to do it. And then, when you take a vow, one of the things that you can do once you've taken a vow is to go to a chacham, a sage, and ask to be freed from your vow. There's a whole process, the whole tractate of the Talmud, which discusses the subject of vows and the process of being freed from vows. You know some of the formula. You know that because you know kol nidre ve'esare v'charame v'chinuye. Veisurei, you know that because of Kol Nidre. And that is, I have to sing it. You know, it's like a Birkat HaMazon. I only can do it if I can sing it. They shall be nullified and canceled and matirin, all of those things. That's the language for freeing yourself from a vow. So here, a guy decided he wasn't going to get his hair cut. Changed his mind on Chol HaMoed. Mother yelled at him. Goes, but it doesn't matter. Mother yelled at you. You took a vow. You have to keep your vow. See, mother says, you don't have to keep your vow. You go to a sage. The sage will free you from your vow. That's a process. So he goes to the sage, and the sage frees him. Okay? So that's that one. Shehitir lo chachamim. Echein mi shenish'al lechacham v'hutar. I'm sorry, I skipped. Bahaminudeh. Right? A person under a ban. A person under a ban. Now, there are a variety of bans that the rabbis can impose on people who will not abide by the law. Okay? You will sometimes see it referred to here as somebody who is, let's see, it's excommunicated. That's a very serious ban. You know, you say that in Hebrew? Cherem. If somebody is put in cherem, they're put in a very serious ban. There is another ban which is less serious, which is really not, I don't think excommunication is a good translation. I'd like to just call it a ban. But it's a 30-day period when, in effect, you are excluded, excommunicated in certain ways from participating in the life of the community. Okay? The person who is a minudeh, all right, the court will declare, somebody decides, I'm not going to obey the law. There are a variety of things you can do with somebody who's not going to obey the law. You can throw them into jail. That's one possibility. Frequently, what the rabbis did was that they used social approbation as a means of coercing people to observe the law. In other words, this guy became an outcast. And he had to act like an outcast. People would be limited in their conversation with him. In a tight society, it hurts if you're an outcast. In addition, he was not allowed to look good. He was forced by the court to not look good, again, to create a mentality of an outcast, of being separate from the normal intercourse with people. This person was not allowed to cut his hair. The normal ban lasted for 30 days. So let's say 25 days before Passover, he was put under a ban. 25 days pass, comes Passover. 5 days into Passover, it's Chol HaMoed, the ban expires. Question, can the guy get a haircut? The Mishnah says yes. The person who is under a ban can. Okay. Somebody who is a mitzora, somebody who has this skin condition, according to the Torah, some kind of either leprosy or something like it, and mitzora, once declared a mitzora, cannot cut his hair. After he has finished the process of purification, he must cut his hair. Same thing is true of the Nazirite. The Nazirite must cut his hair. And indeed, this can very well be that we are talking about when the Mitzora, given the timing that the Torah says, when you in fact complete that period which is a purification period, the end of which you must cut your hair, the Mishnah is saying this guy can cut his hair, right? Because the Torah tells him to. Same is true of the Nazirite. The Nazirite takes a vow. He can't cut his hair as a Nazirite. It's part of being a Nazirite. A Nazirite cannot come in contact with death. There are a variety of possibilities here. The Nazirite cannot cut his hair. What if it's, let's say, it takes a normal ban of a normal Nazirite-ship is for 30 days? It can be longer than that. You can say, if he says, I'm just a Nazirite, the assumption is it's a 30-day vow that he's taken. He doesn't cut his hair for 30 days. What if that ends in the middle of Pesach? He can cut his hair. Okay? So in all of these cases, you see, we are reading about exceptions, some of the exceptions of which are sort of built into the laws, the Nazirite or the Mitzvah. Others of which are hardship cases, where a person is coming from a distance or is in captivity of one kind or another. And in all these cases, we are making an exception. Again, we have not yet really fleshed out the assumption behind all of this, which is, why can't regular people cut their hair? The Mishnah has not said that. Question?
As it appears to me, presumption that cutting your hair is something before the holiday is something you should do.
Correct. You see, it appears to be a presumption that cutting your hair is something you should do before the holiday. It's good. Good wringing that out of the material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Israel, a lot of people know. Before the holidays,
and in Israel, you don't think in New York?
I don't know, in New York.
Why do I tell everybody? In New York, before the Yontif, you've got to get a haircut. Everybody, you have to remember always to get a haircut. Yes?
There also seems to be a presumption that these categories of people have a great urgency to have their haircut, that they can't wait another week.
Correct. Okay? Let's leave it at that.
Thank you.
Wow.
So, is he coming back?
I don't think it's right.
I don't care.
I mean,
more elementary, I think.
What is it?
Hmm?